Hello, I'm Rob Califf, and it's great to be here with you again. We're at the American Heart Association in Los Angeles. A nice venue for the meeting. It's about 90 degrees here in this time of year, so pretty spectacular. And I'm delighted to have Jack Lewin with me today. Jack has just finished a stint running the American College of Cardiology, quite an adventure.
Yep.
But that's only one chapter in a long story of medical practice and medical politics and all sorts of interesting things. So welcome.
Rob, thanks. It's great to be here.
I like to start out these interviews with childhood.
Okay.
What's your story? Where were you born and what were your parents like?
Well, like most Americans, I was born in New Jersey. But my parents moved out to California when I was just a toddler. So I grew up in California. Did medical school and internal medicine, actually at USC.
Where in California did you...
I grew up near Newport Beach in Southern California. A very nice place to grow up as a kid. You know, surfing and the beach
It wasn't so wild that it distracted you from your scholarly activities?
No. It was kind of, rural as I was growing up in Orange County in those days, frankly, compared to the way it is now. I spent a good part of my career in the U.S. Public Health Service in Northern Arizona, which was a fantastic experience. And that's where I had to pick up a lot of cardiology because, frankly, there was no cardiologist within hundreds of miles.
You had to carry the burden.
Yeah, and then later in similar kinds of things happened in Hawaii because I practiced in Maui and Oahu. And there was no cardiology service. So I had to run the ICU at the hospital there. And I got connected to the American Heart Association. The college in those days because of the need to bring in the best science and to kind of stay in touch.
Let's go back, though, to the beginning. You have brothers and sisters.
I have two brothers. And
you're the youngest or the...
I'm the oldest.
You're the oldest.
Right,
And what did your parents do for a living?
My father was literally a rocket scientist. He was an engineer, aerospace engineer. He designed zero-gravity fuel systems that had applications in the rocket engine for the Apollo command module and the little landing device. And then he turned that same technology into inventing a heart, a disposable membrane oxygenator for heart-lung transplants.
Wow.
And Shiley Labs picked that up, his invention. And it was all the same sort of stuff. It was like running fluids, concurrent fluid things. So my father was a scientist. My mother... had some business experience, but she was largely a housewife raising us. And
I have two engineering sons. Would your father say he's a scientist or an engineer? I've learned from my sons that there's a bit of a discussion that goes on there.
He would call himself a scientist. I mean, but at the end of his career, at the beginning of his career, he would have been the engineer for sure.
Yeah.
Because it was really, it changed later on to having to do things that hadn't been done before.
Yeah.
But at the beginning of it, really was engineering, which was drew him, to where he went.
I mean, it's interesting. I mean, as I understand it, the engineers say, well, the scientists are out in outer space. They're just thinking about things. The engineers actually do things.
Yeah.
The scientists say, well, the engineers are just implementing stuff, and we're thinking of the new ideas.
Well, the theme of engineering was to build things at work. So in that sense, he was an engineer. But a lot of what they had to do in the Apollo work had never been done before. So you actually had to, do something new, and needed new fuel systems, new zero gravity way of getting the fuel to move, and new kinds of tubing and equipment to make it happen.
Well, so your mom then had to ride herd over three boys and a father.
Yes, she did.
What were your dinner conversations like?
They were always interesting, always fun and stimulating. And, but we would, one thing we didn't talk about in my family was politics very much. We'd talk about what's happening in the world of science and technology, but not in politics. And yet I've had a profound interest not only in medicine, but as in the politics
Absolutely.
Supporting medicine, because otherwise we doctors become victims and the hospitals become victims to the process.
Are your parents still living?
They both passed away recently, not too long ago. But they had great lives.
That's really important, that the quality of life. And I know family is very meaningful to you. So
yeah,
how did you get so you were a high school kid surfing and all that stuff? How did you get interested in medicine in the first place?
Well, I always had excellent grades, So I went through high school with pretty much a 4.0 average, and I did well on the SATs. I decided to be an aerospace engineer, just like my dad. But a couple years in, I said to myself, this is not me. You know, I mean, I had terrific grades, but I just said, this isn't really me. So I took off and hitchhiked for a year, better part of a year, to my parents' consternation.
To find yourself.
Yeah, and I came back knowing I wanted to be a doctor. And I could apply all that same science, of course. So it actually was very convenient because the engineering infrastructure at the pre-med was a lot the same in terms of advanced math and physics and having a language and so forth.
Right. You know, my youngest son, who was a mechanical engineer and worked in the aerospace industry, now just started medical school.
Great.
At University of Colorado. And it is the way of thinking, I think, is very useful for
The future doctor is going to need to know more engineering. Things are changing.
Yes. So you went to USC as an undergrad?
I went to undergrad at University of California, starting at Berkeley and then at Irvine when it opened.
You were at Berserkley?
I was at Berserkley for a bit
year
of time.
Was that?
It would have been, 65 probably.
Those were pretty wild times at
Berkeley. It was wild times, yeah. And so I went into the calm place of UC Irvine for the last 2 years. It was a brand new
place. Had to escape from the... craziness.
Well, you know, I it was cool for me in that I was being proud about my father's promise to me that if I took off for a year, that I was a man and they didn't have any obligation to fund my education. So by moving down there, I was able to get the job as Jungle Jack at Disneyland. And I could work in the evenings and weekends, and I could, you know, pay my way through UC, which was a great education, and it was dirt cheap. It's ridiculously cheap. I think it was like $70 a quarter, you know.
There was a promise, like similar in North Carolina, as I understand it, that college education in California would essentially be the lowest possible cost. Right?
Yeah, and
that's
changed now, hasn't it? Drastically changed. Now you probably pay $20,000 to go through the University of California, and that's cheap compared to $50,000 at Stanford, right?
Yeah.
But it's, I went to USC Med School because the LA County General Hospital was such a fantastic repository. I could have gone to Columbia. I finally decided to go to UCSF, and a week before school started at UCSF, I had gone down to visit actually a cardiologist, friend of my dad's, at USC, and I was so impressed with the clinical exposure that all the medical students and the interns and the residents had, so much more than what you were getting in most other institutions I visited. At the very last second, I applied a week before school started, got accepted at USC, and began just sort of suddenly.
Now do you think that things like the Vietnam War and the instability in the mid-60s, did that affect you as you were sort of trying to find yourself?
It did, you know. I mean, I was very much opposed to the war like a lot of my fellow students were, but I would have gone if I had been drafted. I had a really low number. I mean, I was never going to get it in the lottery. So what I did after the war was over, by the time I was, you know, through with training, and I then volunteered to go into the U.S. Public Health Service. And at the time, they didn't pay off any loans. They were hurting. Everybody had been deployed to Vietnam. I went out to the Navajo, and I had a fantastic experience there, Rob, where I was running this tiny little remote clinic and hospital in Monument Valley, Arizona and Utah border, and somehow or other, over 5 years later, it's hard to imagine how this happened, but I was the regional director of the entire Southwest of Indian Health Service with multiple hospitals, thousands of employees. So it was my first taste at running something, and the reason I was in that position is because I saw so many opportunities to improve care.
Leadership thing, did that, were you like high school president, or?
I was, you know, I was college president, you know.
Okay, so you were always in the leadership.
It's always been built into me, you know. I would be going around canvassing for candidates for public office when I was in high school, and my parents would go, "What's wrong with you?"
So did your medical school education at USC meet your expectations that you had developed about?
It really did. You know, when I went on the Navajo, You know, if somebody got scraped up off the highway and they needed a chest tube, they needed a central line, they needed, you know, a whole lot of emergency stuff, I was ready to deal with that. And I'd see people come in who would rotate through as doctors, and they would be, I mean, scared to death of being out there without, you know, without all the support services. So I felt very, very good about how clinically prepared I was for critical medicine.
So your specialty was family medicine, right?
Well, I actually did an internal medicine training.
Okay, so it was internal medicine.
But when I got into the Indian Health Service, literally you had to do everything. I mean, you know, you had to be ready to deliver a baby. And so I did learn a lot about, you know, I never would have considered myself skilled as a pediatrician, quite frankly, because it's so different. But that Indian Health Service experience did expose me to a lot of the rest of medicine.
So you did a residency at USC.
I did.
So you did the whole thing there. I have to say, you know, I haven't spent a lot of time at L.A. County, but...
It's a great place.
Yeah, you learn a lot there.
It's changed. You know, today it's a much smaller facility. It had 3,000 beds back in those days. And now it's probably... You know, 1,800.
Only 1,800. were there any people at the USC Med School that had a big influence on you?
Yeah, you know, there were a few people that, you know, an internist by the name of Telfer Reynolds, whose expertise was in liver disease. You know, he was just, there were several professors whose encyclopedic knowledge of medicine and his integrity and whose love of medicine just grabbed me, and there was a cardiologist in that mix. But you know, it was a terrific opportunity to meet people who love medicine. You kind of wonder today, is something changed? Is there some attitudinal change where maybe people are a little bit more skeptical about medicine? I tend to think not. I tend to think things are still really terrific for doctors in medicine, but I think times have changed.
So would you say you had a mentor along those ways? Or was...
I had several mentors. I definitely did have several mentors. There was a mentor earlier in my life who was a physician at the University of California, Irvine, who really solidified my, you know, the sense that this is going to be a great career for me. And my father-in-law has been a mentor. My wife's dad is a radiologist. He was the head of Scripps Clinic. And before my wife and I ever got connected together as a couple, I knew her dad and her mom. In some ways, they almost betrothed us. But I went down and worked for him at Scripps for a bit of time.
This is after the Indian Health Service?
No, this was actually while I was still in med school and you know, during the training years. I went down and did a couple of clerkships down there. And it was a wonderful experience. But he's always been, you know, kind of there as a mentor. Early on, gave me a card when I was giving a speech as student body president at UC Irvine and said, "You will be a doctor someday. Call me when you get to med school."
Huh.
And I kept that card.
Really interesting. Wow. Yeah. So you finished your Indian Health Service time, and how did you end up in Hawaii?
You know, that was really by accident. We had spent 7 years out on the Navajo almost, and we had two kids, and I was thinking of going back to USC and then doing, you know, cardiology was one of my thoughts at the time, doing a fellowship there and maybe, you know, connecting in somehow in Southern California where family was for us. But someone called me and said, "We need somebody as a locum tenens for a couple weeks." So that dragged on for 16 and a half years, Rob. So I stayed. We stayed. My wife didn't want to go at first. And when she got there, she said, "This is my home, by the way." And then we had another child there. Our kids basically grew up in Hawaii. Governor tapped me to be the commissioner director of health. And so I went from, you know, running a practice, starting an independent practice association, being, you know, running the ICU, being part of the Maui rather small infrastructure of doctors, to running a 6,000-employee, billion-dollar statewide agency and pursuing getting universal coverage implemented across Hawaii.
Now, your when you first went to Hawaii, were you in solo practice, or were you you joined a group?
I was in a small group practice with two other doctors. Okay, and I eventually kind of led that practice. I tried to turn that whole thing plus a lot of the other smaller practices into an independent practice association, and I was building that infrastructure so that we'd have a larger base of doctors to represent ourselves in a more favorable fashion with hospitals and insurers. And
that's when you got tapped.
I got tapped, and I end up going over to Oahu, and which was a wonderful experience, by the way, but it was clearly like a big management job. And part of that job was that I took the community county hospitals in the neighborhood islands and built them into a private public-private hospital system. And I also served as the CEO of that hospital system. So I've seen healthcare from a lot of angles.
Yeah. So what's happened to the two guys who were your, when you first started, or your fellow practitioners in that practice?
Oh, yeah. One is still there, a practicing internist in Maui today. He loves it, and he's a happy guy doing that. I have no idea where the other guy is. He's somewhere on the mainland.
Somewhere out there. So running a state agency gives you a whole different perspective, doesn't it?
It sure does. Working for a governor gives you a whole different perspective.
Tell me what you mean about that.
Well, you know, the governor's the boss, and there's politics, you know, dominating things. So if you're working in the Obama administration or any previous administration as a secretary of one of the big agencies, they'll all tell you that there's a lot of power control in that White House, and you have to kind of toe the line sometimes, and kind of do what's considered good based on whose office is where the buck stops. So that's the governor.
Well, you know, I don't think it's that different in academic medicine. You know, when you're...
No.
The way I've always said it is when you're a rank-and-file cardiologist in a cardiology division, you've got a chief cardiology, but you pretty much do what you want as long as you meet certain expectations. Then you get to be a chief of cardiology or a chair of medicine, and people think, you've got all the power. But in fact, you're very dependent on the relationship with it. The higher up you get, the more dependent it seems you are on the person who's right above you, because it becomes very... interpersonal.
I agree with you.
So that match is so critical.
It's very true, and it's part of, you know, what the leadership curve has to, you know, has to prepare you for.
So, and how did you get along with the governor? Was it easy to talk along?
I love the guy. I still am friends with him. He was a very visionary person. He's the first Hawaiian governor, a lawyer. Just an incredible man.
So you admit that you get along with lawyers. I want to make sure that's on the record.
Yeah, you know, he and I did have a great relationship. And there was a place where I felt like I had pretty much an open opportunity to innovate. So we got a universal health care law, which had been bogged up in the courts for years, actually implemented. We created a lot of public health programs. They were significant. Started actually looking at early stages and measuring outcomes and looking at results and building epidemiologic models to predict what's going to happen to some populations at risk, all of which needs to happen today still.
Hawaii is a model a lot of people look up to. Other people would say it's almost socialist in the way it approaches this.
It is, but it's all private sector. You know, what people don't get out of it is it's a 10-page law that does, you know, a lot of what the Affordable Care Act does. It provides insurance for all working persons and their families. And it means even if you have one employee, if you have a gardener who works more than 20 hours a week or a nanny who works for you, you have an obligation with that person to split the cost of insurance. So the employee has to pay part of it, too. And it's really an employee and employer-based system. But it was 10 pages, very simple, private sector coverage. The benefits were defined as the average benefit package being offered in the commercial marketplace.
And is that the system still in place in Hawaii?
It's still in place in Hawaii. The U.S. Congress messed it up a little bit in approving. It had to go through Congress to get approval as an exception to the ERISA law. Mm-hmm. That preempts states from doing things like this. And Congress wrote in some nasty little features, like freezing the employee's share of the spending at what it was then, which it didn't freeze the family part of the cost, but that shifted over time a greater burden of the premium cost to the employer, and that was never the intention of the law. It was really supposed to be a split 50-50.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
So, as I understand it, you thought about running for governor.
I ran.
You did run?
I ran, yeah.
So tell us about that. That must have been wild.
It was. You know, well, my boss, the governor, didn't get along very well with his lieutenant governor, who had been was running for governor and planning to run for years and years. So, you know, about 6 months before the election, he said to me, "You got to do this. You got to go for it. You've got the name recognition." And, you know, I probably should have said, you know, wait a minute, this needs at least a year. But anyway, it was a closely contested race. And if I'd had a few more months, I would have won. And I came very close to winning. It was really a fun experience, with the exception, Rob, of the fact that it stripped all the available money that we'd saved for retirement was gone. You know, any real estate value we had accrued was stripped away. Before it was over, a lot of money got spent. And we raised a lot of money, but not enough in 6 months to do the trick. But still won most of the votes in Honolulu, where everybody was being ordered to canvass for another candidate.
Wow. So what was that like? Here you had finished your term in a job, and then you lost the election, agreeing that you felt good about the race that you had run, but then the day after.
Yeah.
What?
There were a number of clinical positions I could return to that were waiting for me. But I decided to hang up a shingle as a healthcare consultant, given my experience, you know, over the last 8-year period as running this big billion-dollar agency and getting involved in national politics and so forth. I thought, maybe it's time for me to do this. So I actually established the consulting company I'm currently occupying again. Yeah. I mean, it's been there sitting in mothballs since then. But I had a very fun year. I worked for the Department of Health and Human Services. I worked with physician organizations, helping them deal with managed care and get prepared for it. I worked on some public health issues, and it really was a rewarding year. And I look back and as a time when I actually was close with my family. I had more time to be with my kids and my wife, and more control of my time. So,
but that ended.
That ended. I got recruited to go to the California Medical Association in part to help them write a similar law in California for universal coverage. And in fact, we did get that law written and passed, which has been forgotten, because Arnold came in and with a ballot initiative to overturn the law before it was ever fully implemented. So it would be the equivalent of having the Affordable Care Act wiped out next year.
Uh-huh.
You know,
we're going to get to that.
Yeah, and Arnold, meanwhile, was open to trying something different with an individual mandate, and I actually did try to help with that effort while I was there, but it was ill-fated in the sense that his party was never going to support it, and the Democrats weren't going to give him that recognition.
Did you get to know Arnold?
Yeah, he was an interesting man and an interesting governor. I got to know his predecessor much better, Gray Davis.
Gray didn't come across well in the national scenes.
He, you know, behind the scenes, he's a pretty good guy.
I have that impression.
Yeah, he was a competent governor.
He's just not a magnetic television person.
He was not he just wasn't out there to be Mr. Popular, and he ended up, obviously getting recalled because people were mad about state spending and all the sort of stuff that's still going on, that Jerry Brown's dealing with now.
Where's California medicine headed as a particular niche? I mean, obviously, you're in that job for a while. You have a good feel.
Yeah.
For it.
Well, California medicine has remained connected to HMO capitated managed care for many of the beneficiaries in the state. So almost half the workforce can choose PPO coverage, but they often choose HMO coverage. And it's not just Kaiser Permanente. It's across the whole spectrum of plans. So California is unique in that regard. You'd think the doctors there have figured that out, and largely they have, because many doctors are in independent practice associations. So even if they're small small office, 2, 3, 4, 5 doctors. The IPA allows them to negotiate in the HMO for payment. Mm-hmm. They get a per member per month capitation over what it is, including cardiology patients, for example. And to some extent, I think that's where the biggest opportunity for an upside has been, given that fee-for-service gets kind of debunked increasingly. I predict that across the country in the future, that cardiologists and all physicians who want to succeed are going to learn that they need to get engaged and to have clinical data to be able to negotiate based on their own quality and performance and have it be legitimate data. They need to, I think, move toward taking some risk, because otherwise all the upside is going to go back to the insurers and payers and Medicare. So if doctors want to survive in the new world that we're entering, they need to be able to play, take some risk, and not give it all to hospitals and insurance companies. That's a big issue.
So as you know, my good friend Bob Harrington has just moved from Duke to Stanford, where part of his job is going to be to try to build Stanford up as a more potent clinical enterprise. They've been very focused on basic science with some
right.
expert clinicians, of course. What advice would you give Dr. Harrington?
Well, I'd have to get down and get in the nitty-gritty with him in terms of the neighborhood in which he would be practicing, in terms of his relationship to Palo Alto Medical Foundation and Sutter, his relation to all the large medical groups and IPAs in the South Bay. So it's not an easy one. Remember when UCSF and Stanford said they were going to merge and it blew up? Well, so I still think that's an idea that it should be explored. I think that if I was there, I would think that building a bigger network would make sense both on the clinical side and also on the research and academic side.
They've got a lot of money at Stanford and a lot of goodwill, so it'll be interesting to see how my friend does. But let go. We're short on time, and we could spend a couple of hours here because this is really fascinating. But you moved on then to the ACC.
Yeah.
And that was quite a ride.
It's a fantastic organization. The ACC, the people that brought me in said, we'd like to be known as the American College of Cardiology, the ACC, not a basketball league. We want some national recognition. Everybody thinks of the wonderful accomplishments of the Heart Association, but the ACC didn't feel like it was well known. Said, so get us on the national stage. Get us on the international stage. And my caveat to them was, let's go all the way with measuring quality of care. Let's take the PCI, CATH PCI registry in its nascent form and go all the way with that. And they said, okay, let's do it. And that was to me the most exciting thing, because Rob, ACC, when I got there in 2006, its revenue stream, which is about half of what it is today, back then, was tripartite, about equal. Dues, education program revenues, and journal revenues, okay? Today, the biggest source of revenues is data coming out of the registries. That's the future. And that's why STS and the ACC and other and some of the organizations across the EU and the OECD nations now are understanding this. This is the domain of physicians. But that was, I think, the most exciting part about where the ACC has gone.
What are your lessons learned about cardiology and its relationship to the rest of the world? It's been, for me, it's been fascinating as a, rock hard coronary care unit director for 20 years, and now having dealing with a lot of other issues
yeah.
in medicine. You started out dealing with all the other issues in medicine,
yeah.
and then
yeah.
Represented the cardiologist of the
yeah. Well, I think the cardiologists have a fantastic future and are in a much better position than most other specialties, if not any specialty, in succeeding. And partly because, cardiology has more science attached to it. It has more ability to measure across the cardiovascular spectrum. And I want to include our cardiothoracic surgeons as partners in that thinking. But also cardiology is going to be just still at the forefront of need because of the diabetes and obesity and what's coming as the boomers age. So it's going to be a golden era with the science. And I'd say the things that really impress me about what should people be thinking about. One, science is going to move even faster. So the progression of science and how we stay up with it is going to be a challenge. Second is info technology and big data. Analytics is going to be unbelievable. There will be nowhere to hide in terms of poor performance. In the very near future, we'll know everything about performance and about hospitals and doctors, and it's coming. You have to be ready for it and be ready to be good and be at the top of your game. And then the delivery and payment reforms are going to be incredible. Remote procedures and all kinds of new technology and science and personalized medicine and genetics and so forth. And then consumerism is not a fad. You know, consumers are going to be paying half the bill shortly out of pocket as soon as 2019. They're going to be start to shop around. They're going to have data to do that. Consumers are going to be much more significant players. And then finally, you know, the theme would be for what about more leadership from doctors? We should be the CEOs of hospitals, the CEOs of insurance companies. We should get into more leadership roles in industry and in academia all the way to the top, because I think that will benefit medicine hugely. That may be an aspirational goal for medicine. The others are coming, whatever, but we need to go there.
So what do you say to the old-fashioned cardiologists who just liked it the way it was?
Continue to practice in whatever way you can and enjoy it. I mean, you should enjoy it. But if you're a young cardiologist looking at the explosion of science and big data and the changing delivery world and so forth, yeah, you need to get in and help design how that future looks and be part of the development of it rather than waiting for somebody else to do it to you. Because it's the opportunities are huge, but the risks are huge. So there'll be winners and losers. And I would say get engaged and think even about taking risk and, you know, in that capitated, you know, kind of payment model of the future, there'll be much more opportunity than there will be in fee-for-service or bundles or episodes. And so the boldest, bravest, the Willie Suttons of tomorrow are going to head out there and they're going to figure out how to provide better care at lower costs, better outcomes at lower costs. And that's the way out of the mess the nation's in.
So just a couple of things in finishing here, but they're important. What is the next 5 years for Jack Lewin?
I'm going to do something in the delivery system that transforms care. And I think it would have to... I want to look at how to get... For the 5% of Americans that consume 50% of the resources, that would be a first target for me. And I am actually working now with some corporations about developing new models of care with telemedicine, biomonitoring. I predict most consults will be remotely handled, not in person, you know, with the patient and using telemedicine in the future. But I want to build those new models and get them going because that's where the savings are going to be. And the patients in these very advanced illness categories are not getting the best care. So it's for them as well. That's one big thing. The other one for me is the data and the analytics part of being able to track how we're doing. So those are the two areas that I'm spending my time in the consulting world, and it's just a blast for right now.
Well, you're a lucky man in that regard. But let's close with a little bit coming back to aerospace engineering and your family. Mm-hmm. You know, we sort of crossed paths in Boulder, Colorado, where my favorite restaurant there is called The Kitchen. And actually, just last week, I was in Boulder, and with my two kids living out there, we actually ended up eating at The Kitchen in Denver, which is the new
one. Oh, yeah, the new one, yeah.
The new one.
Uh-huh.
What's your family up to, and what is this in-law thing you have?
My son is one of the head leads for the Bing team for Microsoft in Silicon Valley. His wife's a startup person. They're both met at Stanford. Our daughter and her husband have, you know, been the founders of PayPal and Tesla with his brother, the electric car, and even principals in SpaceX, which is now delivering payloads to the space station. And, you know, it's been fun watching these young individuals develop this new world. And go for it. It's really been a total trip. But on the sideline, they like to eat, so you know, they create some great restaurants as well too.
It's kind of amazing. I didn't know your dad was an aerospace engineer, and here you are now with it still in the family in a very creative way.
He would be just so excited to see what's going on with SpaceX.
Well, this is great. I appreciate you taking the time to talk. I'm sure that the audience will get a real blast out of this and will learn some things they ought to be thinking about. So thanks again.
Rob, thank you.